Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second of this year's Robins Lectures. I'm the late Lord Robins's son-in-law. I have the honour to represent the Robins family here on the platform, as I do every year, and it's a great pleasure to welcome yet another Robins lecturer. And I think I must say, in compliment to André Schleifer, that he is the only Robins lecturer I remember who has actually mentioned other Robins lecturers and referred to their work, which shows how very well he's prepared himself. The fact that he disagrees fundamentally with both Robert Barrow and Darren Acemoglu doesn't in any way diminish the compliment he's paid them by referring to their lectures. I'd just like to say one other thing, which is that I spent quite a lot of my time at school learning medieval history. And I was fascinated by it, and I often thought, well, this is completely useless. And that is, of course, the great criterion for education and culture, that it mustn't have any practical use. But now, rather late in life, I've learnt that all this medieval history is in fact highly relevant, and those of you who came yesterday will understand why it's relevant to the study of economics. And Professor Schleifer is now going to take us further on this fascinating journey, and he's going to talk about why does legal origin matter so much. André Schleifer.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for coming and enduring more of this. As some of you may recall, I argued yesterday that legal origin stands for an approach to social control of the economy and the society, and in particular that the French legal system or the Roman legal tradition stands for the administrative approach to social control of business and of social problems, whereas the common law stands for the more decentralized approach based on contracting and based on dispute resolution in court. So what I will try to do in this lecture and the next is to present some evidence that I hope will convince you that there is, in fact, some substance to these assertions beyond just the amateur discussions of medieval history that I've shared with you. So this is basically the summary of what I'm going to try to do in these next couple of lectures. And this is pretty much a decade of work involving dozens of people collecting data. But the top of this panel basically deals with today's lecture, and the bottom of the panel deals with tomorrow's lecture. So what I will try to suggest to you and to document empirically is that there is a connection first between legal origins and the particular structure of rules and regulations in different countries, and then that there is a connection between these institutions and economic outcomes that we might be interested in. So what are the institutions that I am going to look at? Well, there are four groups of institutions that I will consider today. One is procedural formalism. By procedural formalism, I mean something very specific, which is the regulation of dispute resolution in courts themselves. As you recall, I argued yesterday that one of the characteristics of the civil law tradition is the distrust of judges and law enforcers, and as a consequence, the legal procedures themselves, the way in which cases move through through the legal system are heavily regulated by courts. And so what I'll try to do today is to, in fact, show you that procedural formalism can be measured in different countries and that it has significant consequences for various outcomes. I will also look at another institution, which is judicial independence, and that is, again, the core of the difference between the civil law system and the common law system, at least, as envisioned conceptually by the people or by both the exposed analysts of these systems and the designers of various rules, which is to say that the essence of a common law system is the independence of judges from the sovereign, whereas the essence of the civil law system is state-employed judges and subordination of the judiciary to the legislative. And again, I'll try to look at that to see whether there are variation in judicial independence across legal traditions and whether it has consequences for property rights and so on. I will also look at two things that do not have immediately to do with courts and judges, but which are also consequences of the broader implication of the legal approach that I've outlined yesterday. I will look at the regulation in different countries of the entry by small businesses, asking again the question whether civil law countries, in their administrative approach to social control in general and social control of business in particular, impose heavier ex-ante burdens on entrepreneurs who try to open an official business. And I will compare that to the common law countries. And again, I'll examine some of the consequences. And finally, I will look at one final set of institutions today, which is the laws regulating the employment relationship. And I will again ask whether there are differences in the structure of these laws and in the burden of these laws across legal traditions, and whether these consequences, whether these differences in institutions have consequences for particular outcomes. So that's the basic empirical outline, and then I'll try to deal with a couple of additional issues to the extent that there is time. Now, before I turn to the empirical work, I want to emphasize three very important points about this empirical research design. First, I'm going to be comparing large samples of countries, large numbers of common law countries, somewhere between 15 and 35, depending on the study, and large samples of civil law countries and French civil law countries, again between 15 and maybe 40, depending on the study. I am not comparing the United Kingdom to France, and I'm not comparing France to the United States. Now, this is very important because a lot of people in France in particular have interpreted this work as an attack on their country. And in fact, some of you may know that the French Ministry of Justice has established a study group intended to evaluate this work critically, with the emphasis on critically. Now, there are a couple of points to make in this respect, which I will not discuss in great length, but first of all, France is in many ways an unrepresentative French civil origin country in the sense that it has experienced considerably more legal evolution and in many important respects considerably more convergence toward a common law system than many of the French civil law countries, particularly French civil law countries in West Africa, Latin America, and other parts of the world. So a lot of these statements empirically are really not about France, but about Latin America. And in fact, there is a lot of ongoing research suggesting that legal evolution has been much more significant in the richer country than in the poorer ones. The second point I want to emphasize is that it is critical in this research design that we're actually measuring institutions, which is that the reason there are hundreds of hours of labor that go into these projects is that we are not just looking at the association between legal origins and outcomes, which would be a rather trivial thing to do, but we are collecting from actual laws and regulations the data on these intermediate things, namely the institutions, which is that we're going to go to national laws and measure procedural formalism, measure constitutional measures of independent of judges, measure the number of steps that it takes to regulate to enter if you are a small firm, and measure labor laws. And so the proposition that's being made here, or the hypothesis that's being proposed, is not just that there is a correlation between legal origin and outcomes, but rather that there is a specific channel of this correlation, and that is that the institutions that we observe and that we can measure are actually take the form that is predicted by this hypothesis about the difference between common law and civil law. So the criticism, some of the criticism of our work, which is to say that when we talk about common law versus civil law, we're just relabeling something else that may be totally uncorrelated, such as language or the prosperity of common law countries in the last decade or two, is not really valid, because we are taking the pain to make this intermediate step of measuring institutions. Third, and related to the previous point, in designing this research, we believe that it is crucially important to measure institutions objectively. That is to say, to go to the basic laws, basic regulations, and try to quantify them. And that is, from a variety of points of view, superior to the approach that has been taken in some other work that I've referred to yesterday, which is to try to just look at the surveys of investors or of business people. And the reason for that, of course, is that first of all, you know what you're measuring, and second of all, if you start thinking about reform or change, you can actually try to understand empirically which aspects or which characteristics of institutions might be detrimental to performance. So having said that, let me just take you through some of the evidence and show you the kind of work that my colleagues and I have been doing. So this is a study of legal formalism. And this is a study that was conducted with Laporta López de Silanes and Simeon Diankov of the World Bank. And basically what we have done is we went to law firms, which belong to a particular umbrella organization called Lex Mundi, and in 109 countries around the world. And we said, suppose you had a problem that your client came to you with, which is that somebody gave them a check in payment for something, and the check bounced. They presented the check to the bank, and the check bounced. And suppose you wanted to take the party that wrote the check to court so as to collect on this bounced check. Describe all the steps and all the procedures that would be necessary to take this matter through your country's court system, looking at the lower-level city trial courts. And so what we tried to do is basically to extract them from them in exhaustive detail what exactly would they need to do representing this merchant who has collected a check that has bounced in order to collect legally on this bounce check going through the country's courts. Now, what were the things that we measured? Well, we asked the question whether in order to do that, the client will need to hire a professional lawyer or whether he would be able to do that on his or her own. We asked whether the arguments at trial or in these proceedings could be oral or whether, in contrast, there have to be written submissions to the court with the idea that, again, written submissions would correspond to greater legal formalism, whether there will need to be a legal justification for the claim, that is to say, when you complain to the court, whether you can just say, look, this person wrote a check to me and the check has bounced, or whether you need to find the exact laws and regulations that have been violated that have been violated when a check was bounced, whether there is a statutory regulation of evidence, that is to say, whether there are restrictions on how the evidence can be presented to a court, in what form, what evidence can be presented and what evidence cannot be presented, whether there is control of superior review, that is to say, what is the structure of appeal and at what point the person who has bounced the check can appeal the decision, whether there are engagement formalities, that is to say, whether there is just an oral hearing in front of a judge, or whether there are particular steps that need to be taken in a particular sequence, including, for example, the notification of the person who bounced the check. In some countries, you have to notify them by mail 3 times and to have evidence that the mail has, in fact, been accepted, and so on. Whether there are these formalities involved in following the procedure legally. And so engagement formalities refer to these kinds of procedural details in the course of a trial. The independent procedural actions refer to these kinds of formalities at the stage of notifying the person who bounced the check and at the stage of enforcing the court's decision. So we have presented the case as if the facts were absolutely unambiguous. In other words, the check was submitted and the bank refused to pay it. And we asked these law firms to describe the procedures in detail. Based on these, we collected information on these 7 aspects of the judicial procedure. And based on these 7 aspects, we constructed the index of legal formalism, which ranges from 0 to 7, where 7 means the higher level of control or intervention in the judicial process, and 0 means the lowest. So the idea is that you get a 0 if you can just show up to a judge, tell the judge orally that somebody has just bounced a check on you. The judge has an oral discussion, perhaps orally questions some of the witnesses. There are no professionals being present, and then judge issues a verdict. So this is a totally informal, way of collecting a bounced check, in contrast to the extent that you need to go through fairly formalized steps and involve professionals. You're going to have a high score for legal formalism. So we've done that for 109 countries, and what you see here is the averages in the case of check collection for legal formalism scores across legal origins. And what you find is the first finding is that common law countries tend to have sharply lower legal formalism scores than French legal origin countries, that German and Scandinavian legal origin countries are somewhere in the middle, and that socialist legal origin countries are pretty tightly controlled and regulated in this legal procedure as well. So this is consistent with the theory that the regulation of judicial procedures is heavier in civil law countries, in French civil law countries in particular, than in common law countries. This is the same analysis done for another case, just for robustness, which is the eviction of a tenant for non-payment of rent. Again, going through, this is for the case of a country's largest city. Again, going through all the details. And again, for these data, you have the same finding lowest level of legal formalism in common law countries, highest level of legal formalism in civil law countries, in particularly French civil law countries. This is a totally different country, totally different study based on totally different data. So here, instead of working with 109 law firms, what we do is something much simpler, which is we read the constitutions of 69 countries, and we ask the question, what are the levels of judicial independence guaranteed in the constitution? And of course, some countries, like the UK, do not have a constitution, and so they would not be in this sample. So we ask what kind of tenure the Supreme Court judges have. So if Supreme Court judges are appointed for life, you get a score of one. If the Supreme Court judges serve at the pleasure of the executive, you get a zero. You get the tenure of the highest level administrative court judges. And administrative courts and Supreme Courts are different in some countries. And we look at whether case law, that is to say judicial decisions, are a legitimate source of law as another measure of judicial independence. And here we find, again, something broadly consistent with the theory, which is to say that common law countries have strikingly higher measures of judicial independence than do French legal origin countries. German legal origin countries, and that the Scandinavian legal origin countries also have very high measures of judicial independence, not surprisingly. Here is a third study that we did, which is now this is done in cooperation with the World Bank, and this is a sample of 85 countries that we've managed to extract data from, and this is perhaps the most easily interpretable measure, and that is the number of different procedures that a startup has to comply with in order to obtain a legal status, i.e. to start operating as a legal entity. And this number varies enormously across countries. So in U.S. and Canada, you can register a business basically by email. You need to get a tax ID, and you need to check that nobody else has the same name as your business, and you're pretty much done. In countries like Bolivia or Colombia, you need to go through 16 or 18 steps. In many countries, you need to produce a marriage certificate. You need to show that you haven't been a criminal. You haven't been a criminal. In Colombia, it's mandatory for any entrepreneur who wants to start a business to get a permit to play music on the premises, regardless of the nature of the business that they're trying to pursue. Well, it's not surprising that richer countries have fewer steps of entry regulation, but what is perhaps more interesting is that there is a striking difference among legal origins, which is to say that common law countries on average have 7.2 steps that an entrepreneur needs to complete before they can begin operating legally. A French legal origin, in an average French legal origin country, an entrepreneur needs to complete 13.4 steps, almost twice as many, before they can begin operating legally. That number is 10%. 10 steps for German legal origin countries, very low 4.5 for Scandinavian legal origin countries, and a high 11.37 for socialist origin countries. By the way, one of the findings that emerges throughout this research, and this is going to be an aside about Scandinavian countries, but it comes through in many ways, which is that these countries tax heavily but regulate lightly, which is this image of Scandinavian countries as being heavily regulated, at least in the research that we've conducted, does not seem to be true. If you look at tax levels, they're very high, but compared to the French legal origin countries, the regulations in these countries seem to be quite low. So that's regulation of entry. And this is finally the last study, which has just been published and has taken many years to complete, which is for the same sample as the regulation of labor studies, and again, this was done jointly with the World Bank, we have asked for information about the protection of labor through employment laws. There is a separate part of this study on social security laws and industrial relations laws that I will not talk about in these lectures. But basically, we looked at four primary aspects of employment protection. That is to say, first, whether there are alternative employment contracts allowed, effectively can a firm weasel out of various employment protection laws through part and various benefits that it has to pay through workers by employing part-time workers or by employing seasonal workers or by employing workers on fixed-term contracts. So this is the alternative employment contracts measure, and here the lower is the score, the easier it is to get out of the regulations. We have collected evidence or data on the cost of increasing hours worked, which is that suppose you want to get more hours out of your existing labor force, how difficult it is or how costly it's going to be for you to do so, whether you need to hire additional workers or whether you can compel your workers to work extra hours for extra pay, how much overtime you need to pay if you want your workers to work harder. So that's the second component of the regulation of labor index. The third component is the cost of firing workers. Again, how much do you need to pay to the employees that you lay off, treating separately individual layoffs and mass layoffs. And finally, how regulated are the dismissal procedures? How much notification do you need to give, whether there are seniority rules in the law and in the Constitution that regulate the order of dismissal, and so on. So again, we have these four aspects of the regulation of labor market, and we look at the averages, average scores, and again, you have the same picture, which is to say that common law countries have the lightest regulation of labor. French origin countries are high, Scandinavian origin countries in this instance are high, German origin and socialist origin are also not as high as French and Scandinavian, but higher than the common law countries. So these are basically the studies, and the question is, you know, what is explaining these results? Is it indeed the case that the interpretation that I've tried to propose yesterday, namely that the levels of regulation, the levels of administrative control of various activities, whether it's judicial procedures themselves or whether it's other spheres of economic and social life, are higher in the French civil law countries than in the common law countries? Or is it something else? Oh, wait a minute. I have one other piece of evidence, excuse me, before I turn to that. This is the best one. I saved the best for last, which is that this is for 162 countries, and this is just the simplest question. And, you know, in case you think it's something else, I think this should give you a pause, which is we just asked the question. We looked at whether different countries have draft people into the military. Now, every single country in the world has some professional soldiers, but in addition, many countries also draft. And so we asked the question for 162 countries in the world, what fraction of the 3 years for which we had data, 85, 90, and 95, they actually had a military draft. And you can do this study controlling for various factors, including the size of the military and so on, and the results are still going to be the same. So this is the data, which is to say, on average, common law countries were drafting, an average common law country was drafting in only 17% of these years, which is to say that that a military draft is something that is absolutely an exception in common law countries. Okay, military draft, if I will try to suggest later, is perhaps the ultimate form of government regulation. And here the common law countries are different from all the other traditions. They're different from French legal origin countries where conscription is nearly universal, German legal origin countries, Scandinavian and socialist legal origin countries. So again, in this area of government regulation, you see big differences. So as I said, again, I'm sorry I got confused. The question is it really legal origin or is it something else? And in particular, there have been two alternative hypotheses that people have proposed that might explain the evidence. The two alternative hypotheses are politics and culture. The politics hypothesis basically says that maybe French legal origin is correlated with more left-wing politics. And so the reason you're finding heavier regulation of various activities in French legal origin countries is that for a reason totally unrelated to law, they have been politically further on the left. Now, if you think about this hypothesis for a moment, it does not seem entirely plausible. First, why would it apply to things like the formalism of judicial procedures and judicial independence? Second, if you think about some of the most heavily regulated countries in the post-World War II period in Europe, you think about countries like Franco's Spain and Salazar's Portugal, which were fascist countries, not socialist countries. And so the hypothesis that what is involved here is leftist politics rather than the historical approach to social control seems implausible. Nonetheless, we've done a lot of work, as have other people, trying to introduce various political variables in order to assess whether or not politics predicts these various measures of government regulation. So one variable for which we've collected some data is this variable called chief executive and the largest party in Congress have left or center political orientation at the same time. So this is a measure of the percentage of years between 1928 and 1995 in one instance, and alternatively, which is much easier, between 1975 and 95, during which both the party of the chief executive and the largest party in Congress had left of center orientation. If the country was not independent in the initial year of the period, we use the independence year as the first year for creating this variable. So that's one measure of leftist politics. Another measure we used is union density. Now, the other sets of variables do not look at leftist politics in particular, but argue that there is something else in the country's politics that may be responsible for the results. One of them is a measure of autocracy. So this is a variable that classifies regimes based on their degree of autocracy. Another variable is proportional representation. It's been argued that countries that have proportional representation have more left-wing politics because the fringe leftist parties are represented in the government and therefore might have heavier regulation of various activities. So this is a measure that equals one if legislators were elected based on the percentage of votes received by their party and zero otherwise. We look at a measure called divided government, which is the probability that two randomly chosen deputies belong to a different party in a given year. And we look at the measure of democracy in addition to a measure of autocracy because it comes from a different data source, which is a measure of degree of democracy based on the competitiveness of political participation, the openness and competitiveness of the chief executive recruitment, and the constraints on the chief executive. Now, except for the first variable here, all of these are variables from generally available databases, the first one we've put together ourselves. Now, I'm not going to bother you with the presentation of the results. Let me just say that these variables never wipe out in the regression the significance of legal origin variables, and in fact, generally have very little explanatory power. Most of the time, for most of the measures of regulation that we've presented, most of these variables are in fact statistically insignificant. So emphatically, we might not have looked at the right aspects of politics, we might not have measured the political variables properly, but to the extent that people have looked at a variety of political variables and a variety of theories suggesting that it's politics rather than the legal tradition that predicts the extensiveness of regulation, these hypotheses have failed. That is to say, it appears to be that legal origin is far more important than any political variables that people have looked at in accounting for the differences in patterns of regulation among countries. We've also looked at some cultural variables, which is basically based on the idea that Catholic and Muslim countries are different from Protestant countries, and in particular, it may be the Catholic way of doing things or of approaching the society that involves more paternalism and greater degree of government intervention and regulation. And so one could look at such variables as percentage of the population that's Protestant, and one can alternatively look at categories of in different religions. And again, the conclusion is the same, which is occasionally you get these cultural variables to matter, but they matter very little. And in no instance do they appear to eliminate the importance of legal origin in explaining the variation in the patterns of regulation across countries. So the conclusion from this part, or at least the first set of arrows from the beginning of the presentation, is that at least based on the research we have done, it seems to be that it's legal origin rather than in legal tradition, rather than culture politics, that explains the variation in the patterns of regulation. Now, what about the outcomes? What I'm going to try to do is, again, look now at the right part of this introductory organizing table that I've shown you and show you some of the outcome regressions. And I'll try to do it quickly. All these regressions control for per capita income, which has generally been seen as a proxy for the quality of law enforcement, for the quality of the enforcement of particular laws in the country. And you can do the quality of the judiciary as a control variable, but you need something to take account of the fact that outcomes tend to be better across the board in the richer countries, quite independently of the legal tradition. So here is the outcome variables we look at. It's the duration of the procedure for check collection and for eviction, the size of the unofficial economy, a measure of corruption, and two measures related to the labor markets. One is male labor force participation, and the second one is unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, which Richard Freeman has shown to be a particularly important consequence of interventions in the labor market. So the results tend to be quite strong across the board. So this is, for example, the relationship between formalism in check collection and the duration of the procedure to collect the bounced check. And what you find is that in some countries like Hong Kong and New Zealand, it may take a couple months to collect a bounced check. In other countries like Venezuela and Panama and Argentina, it may take 6 or 7 years. Eviction of a tenant, you get the same thing. New Zealand, which, by the way, it's not UK or the US that's always the best on all these measures among the common law countries. The paradise in this work is always New Zealand. This is eviction and the duration of the procedure. Again, New Zealand seems to be on one end of the spectrum, Venezuela and Panama on the other, and there is a clear association between formalism and bad outcomes. I should say with respect to this work on the formalism of judicial procedure, we also looked at a database which we did not collect about participant perceptions of the fairness of the courts in the country. The idea being that some would argue that formalism buys fairness and access of poor people to the system of justice. And what we found is that, in fact, it's quite the opposite, which is in countries with heavily formalized judicial procedures, people who use the system perceive it as less fair, less efficient, and less accessible. This is the relationship between judicial independence and the security of property rights. Here, the security of property rights notice is used as an outcome rather than as a measure of institutions, and you find a very strong positive correlation between judicial independence and the security of property rights. Here is the relationship between the regulation of entry and corruption. Here, high corruption scores mean low corruption. To be clear, and you see a lot of variation, but again, you find that the more regulated is the procedure for entry regulation, the more corrupt the country seems to be. This is a statistical confirmation of the hypothesis that was proposed maybe 15 years ago by Hernando de Soto. This is also a relationship between the regulation of entry and the size of the unofficial economy, and you find, although this is marginally significant, that countries with more procedures have a larger size unofficial economy. So one response that businesses have to this heavy regulation of entry is operating unofficially. The regulation of labor seems to be associated with the lower male labor force participation. That is to say, heavy regulation seems to lead to low participation rates or associated with low participation rates. And countries with heavy regulation of labor seem to have sharply higher rates of youth unemployment. So again, everything seems to line up. That is to say, legal origin seems to be associated with heavier regulation, and heavier regulation seems to be associated with some undesirable outcomes. So more generally, what do the data tell us? First, and this is quite important, they tell us that there is no functional equivalence between common and civil law. Different legal and regulatory rules lead to different outcomes. That does not mean that common and civil law cannot in principle accomplish similar things, but just that they do not do so in reality. So how can we think about all this evidence, and can we come up with a somewhat more general way of thinking about these results than the historical introduction that I gave you yesterday? And I want to think a little more theoretically about how we can think about the trade-offs between the cost of operating things privately and the cost of administration that may explain the consequences of different legal traditions. So here is kind of my proposed general way of thinking about the world, and particularly thinking about the social control of business. So think about a society facing two kinds of problems. The first kind of problems are the problems of private expropriation. So these are problems such as murder or theft or monopoly, or sale of low quality or poisonous goods, and so on. I'll broadly refer to it as the problem of disorder. It's intimately related to what economists call market failure, but I want to think of it as my much broader problem in the sense that there are things like murder or theft which do not quite qualify as manifestations of market failure. There is another set of problems, which I'll call social losses due to state expropriation. So these are social losses not from private takings, but from public takings. So these are social losses from government taking things from people, putting people in jail unfairly, taking their property, as we're seeing more and more in the world, but also imposing burdensome and unnecessary costs on private business. Now, think of this, every society, and in fact you can think of this as every industry in a given society, faces a set of institutional possibilities given by this curvy downward sloping curve, which I'll call the institutional possibility frontier. And that is a possible set of institutions that a society may choose in order to deal with the twin problems of dictatorship and disorder. So let's think about a concrete example. Suppose you have an activity which is the issuance of, I'll give an example from finance, even though today's lecture is not about finance, but I think the example may clear the issue. Suppose you have a problem called the promoter's problem, which is that firms want to issue securities in the market, and some of these firms may be fraudulent, and they try to issue securities to unsuspecting market participants, then take the money and run. This is a problem that has that was pervasive in financial markets in England and in Europe throughout history until very recent past, and some may say even not so recent past. And it's a problem that obviously is still pervasive in transition and developing economies. So how can you deal with these problems? Well, one solution is anarchy or private orderings. So a solid Chicago economist might argue that there is absolutely no need for government intervention to deal with this problem, that firms will issue securities, only good firms will issue securities because they will want to establish a reputation for being honest. Not only that, there will be private intermediaries arising in the marketplace, such as stock exchanges or investment banks that will take upon themselves to make investigations of the companies trying to issue securities and to guarantee to potential buyers the quality of these securities. So that's one solution. Now that solution is, as you can see, would be associated with low levels of dictatorship, but potentially high levels of disorder because in many situations, particularly in developing countries, these investment banks or other private institutions might be in cahoots with the issuers and promoters rather than with the investing public. And so markets will fail, as we see very often in most of the world. Now, you can say that, look, maybe private ordering is too much. You need some government regulation. But why don't we have this take the form of independent judges? That is to say, we'll still have no regulation in the marketplace, but in case somebody bought a bunch of securities and then 2 days later it turned out that the company is worthless, they can go to a judge who, based on some common law principles of tort or contract law, will decide whether in fact a company defrauded this particular investor. Now this is the independent judge's approach, which again involves fairly light levels of dictatorship and government intervention, but may still involve some disorder because, for example, if you try to do that, as many people try to do that in many countries, the issuer will say, well, I was myself surprised when I learned 2 days later that my company was worthless, and I didn't really mean to run away with the money, and I thought I had investment opportunities and go out and prove that, in fact, I've defrauded you. And that may, in fact, turn out to be quite expensive. Now, then, you can have a regulatory state, which is the idea that every prospectus, the government will mandate that every company will issue a prospectus, and that not only that, the government regulators, the Securities Exchange Commission or Financial Service Authority, will read every prospectus, will investigate every company to examine the accuracy of the prospectus, and then will itself ascertain that the securities are worthwhile. That, of course, will reduce perhaps the level of disorder, but it will run the risk that the government might decide that it will favor its friends rather over its enemies in allowing them to issue securities. It might decide that some businesses are more worthwhile than others, and it may in fact stop people who are not friends of the government from issuing securities, so the dictatorship cost might be high. Incidentally, between the points of that I call independent judges and the regulatory state, there is another point in the middle, which is a combination where the government may set up a regulatory framework for what a firm must disclose before it issues securities. But then if the firm failed to disclose all the things it needs to, leave the enforcement of these regulations to private litigation. And that, in fact, turns out to be a very attractive strategy in security regulation, as I'll try to explain today. And finally, you can say that, look, the only way you can sell securities is through the post office. And unless it's going to be completely monopolized by the government, and the government's going to do everything it can to guarantee but also to sell securities. And this is full state control. And that, of course, has the huge costs of dictatorship, but controls disorder. Now, if we graph on the x-axis the social losses due to state expropriation, the dictatorship, on the y-axis the social losses due to private expropriation, which I call disorder, what I've drafted here, or drawn here, is the institutional possibility frontier, which is a set of choices a society might in principle face in deciding which institutions to pick. Now, what is an efficient, first of all, these institutional possibility frontiers are going to be very different for societies at different levels of development. And obviously, the more developed a society you have, the further in will be the institutional possibility frontier. That is, the set of options available to Sweden is going to be much more attractive in terms of social costs than the set of options available to Kazakhstan, for example. But what's also the case is that this framework tells you that the efficient point for a given industry, for a given country, is the point of total loss minimization, which is the point of tangency of this institutional possibility frontier with a negative 45-degree line. Now, why is this an interesting way of thinking about legal origin? Well, first, let me restate the model that I've presented yesterday about 12th and 13th century. Essentially, what I tried to suggest is that the trade-off between disorder and dictatorship was different in England than in France, and in particular because France was a much less orderly and much more warlike country. The payoff in favor of dictatorship, the trade-off in favor of dictatorship, was much more attractive than France than in England. That is to say, the reduction in disorder that an incremental unit of dictatorship bought you in France was higher than it was in England. And so I argued yesterday in a somewhat different framework that as a consequence, as a result of perfectly efficient choice, England has favored on, has settled on a system of social control that was more heavily loaded toward accepting disorder relative to dictatorship, namely the common law system, whereas France efficiently adopted a system of social control that more heavily loaded with dictatorship than with disorder. Now, what about the evidence I've presented? As I said, most of the countries that we had in the empirical studies are not England and France, but they are rather countries in the common law tradition where the law has been transplanted, and in the civil law tradition where the French civil law has been transplanted. So how can we reconcile the evidence with this diagram? What I would argue is that, in fact, what you see is that today, in the less developed countries compared to the rich economies from which the laws have been transplanted, the trade-off between dictatorship and disorder is much less attractive. That is to say, the costs of government intervention and the inefficiencies associated with government intervention and dictatorship are much higher in the less developed countries than in developed countries. That is to say, the institutional possibility frontier is flatter in the less developed countries than in the rich countries. And as a consequence of that, as you move out from the developed countries to the less developed countries, you will see that the costs associated with common law and the inefficiency of the common law system is going to be much smaller than the inefficiency of the civil law system. That is to say, whereas in the relatively developed countries, greater government intervention and greater regulation, because the government is of a higher quality, may not lead to high social costs, in the developing countries, this will lead to much higher social costs. And this is what explains the inefficiency associated with civil law that we observe in the data. Now, this analysis is still incomplete, and it's possible to argue that codes were transplanted 200 years ago, but what about new laws, such as the regulation of labor or entry? These laws were, in fact, written in each country on their own, rather than transplanted from France or Spain or Portugal. Why is the effect of legal origin pronounced even in the laws that were not transplanted? I would argue that legal origin shapes not just the codes, but also the legal infrastructure, the structure of dispute resolution, and the human capital of participants in the legal system. When the introduction of new regulations is contemplated, this infrastructure reduces the fixed cost of introducing modes of social control in the same style. Legal origin thus shapes the foundation on which incremental regulations are built. Now, this view, which I've developed in some work with Casey Mulligan, was motivated by the historical work of Issa Wallach, whose book, in fact, I saw was on sale in the bookstore here in the remainder section, on Napoleonic conscription in France. Based on this work, we see legal origin as a proxy for the fixed cost of new regulation, which would argue that it's this fixed cost of incremental regulation because of the infrastructure already in place is lower in French legal origin countries than in the common law countries. Wallach describes how, following the revolution, France established a pervasive administrative state. The country was divided into 8 departments, which were further subdivided down to the village level, with each level administered through a vertical hierarchy and directly accountable to the center. The administration was involved in budgets, police, roads, courts, primary education, hospitals, and some social welfare. Given the level of penetration of the state administration into national life, Wallach argues, draft administration was only the extension of the existing structures. Let me quote, "By Napoleon's choice, conscription constituted the ultimate frontier of state building, of the articulation of the administrative state projected by the revolution. Conscription became the state's obsession, the preoccupation of officials up and down the government hierarchy." Conscription, according to Wallach, was tremendously successful in raising armies. In our more prosaic view, conscription was used successfully in France because the initial administrative innovations created sufficiently invasive governmental structures that could then run the draft without prohibitively expensive incremental mechanisms of assuring compliance. I should say that this approach has one additional non-trivial implication, which you might find interesting. Suppose that it is indeed the case that incremental fixed costs of adding new areas of regulation are important. This has implication not just for legal origins. This theory implies more generally that higher population jurisdictions would regulate more activities because they could spread the fixed costs among more people. This is a testable implication which Casey Mulligan and I have tested. We've tested it both across countries, but also, perhaps to bring a totally new source of data to the table, we tested it across the United States states. And what we try to ask is whether, other things equal, more populous states regulate more activities in the United States. So how did we do that? We went to state laws of 50 U.S. states, and we measured, using a computer, the amount of law they had. In fact, we measured the kilobytes of law, the number of letters. in the laws of different states. Now, you would think it's funny. I thought it was funny as well. But this is what the picture looks like. So this is 2,000 population in thousands. This is on the x-axis, kilobytes of annotated law, on the y-axis, in logs, and you find that there is a perfect, almost perfect linear relationship. And it has nothing to do with the geographic size of the state, with the diversity of its occupations, with its income per capita. None of this matters very much. What matters is that more populous states have more kilobytes of law. We also find that some of the regulations considered in this lecture, specifically the draft and the regulation of entry, are also more extensive in higher population countries holding legal origin constant. These results are consistent with the importance of incremental regulatory costs in shaping national patterns of regulation and with the interpretation of legal origin as a proxy for the style of social control of business. So let me conclude. Legal origin appears to have a pervasive effect on how countries deal with disputes in general and social control of business in particular. Civil law appears to stand to a greater extent for a more administrative approach to solving social problems than does common law, which tends to stress, again, to a greater extent, contracts and dispute resolution in courts. Many basic features of common civil law distinction, such as roles of judges and juries, judicial independence, presence of codes to control judges, etc., are a byproduct of these differences. Because the legal infrastructure supplies the strategies for dealing with new problems, legal origin ends up having a pervasive influence across a broad range of laws, regulations, and interventions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andre, for a fascinating lecture. I'm not sure whether you've left yourself any time for
I have
questions.
A couple minutes.
A couple, okay. Just take a couple of quick questions then. Well, perhaps I could just put one from the chair, which may have occurred to other people, which is, can you tell us how much comparison you've done within each category? I mean, when you look at the common law countries, how much variability is there within those measurements? For example, it's generally considered that the United States is a country where you cannot move in business without having your lawyer at your right hand. That's not the impression we have in Britain. So is there, in fact, quite a lot of variability within these categories?
Yes, there is an enormous amount of variability. And as I've indicated to you, the countries in the common law tradition, which seem to be the outliers in terms of being relatively less regulated, are New Zealand and Canada rather than UK and the US. There is enormous variability, and some of it is quite systematic. That is to say that, generally speaking, richer countries have more favorable regulations than poorer countries do. That's not strictly true. The really, really poor countries tend to have relatively light regulations just because they haven't gotten around to it. It's the middle-income countries, which you think should be least regulated, are in fact the most regulated in the data in many instances. But yes, it certainly is the case that while the R-squared from legal origin dummies, often if you look at these legal scores across countries, are very, very high, often on the order of 30 or 40%, they're certainly not 100%.
That's a supplementary. I mean, are these averages of yours simple averages or weighted averages, in which case one would think the United States would dominate the picture for common
law? No, they're absolutely, we're interested in what the laws mean, so they're simple averages.
Right.
I mean, it's...
So Ghana has the same weight as the United States?
Well, as it should. If we want to try to understand what it is that the law does and what is the structure of the law, then Ghana should have exactly the same weight.
Right.
as the United States. I mean, it all depends on what is the question that you're trying to ask. And if you want to understand differences in legal systems, then you should look at different legal systems.
So I can see a brilliant future for you and your associates in advising businesses which countries to go to if they want to find somewhere that's lightly regulated. Are they better off in Ghana or the United States if they want to bounce a check? But anyway, that's another story. I think we have to let you go to your next appointment, but thank you very much again, and we look forward to the outcome of all these discoveries in the third lecture tomorrow. I'd urge you all to return and save up any questions you may not have been able to put today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.